Well, hello everyone. Radio Solar System is back again now to give you an overview of Module 3. And Module 3 in this course, in a way, is a continuation of the introduction of the course because it introduces ideas about the solar system and also places us in some wider context within the universe and the galaxy. So we'll move along. As usual, you'll know when to change the slides when you hear this distinctive sound, so you can move along now. This just kind of gives you an overview of the material that's in this particular module. We talk a little bit about our human interest in the heavens and where this started and what we've learned from it, and also where some of the words we use come from too. We'll say a few words about how we gain information about the solar system today, which obviously is quite different than those that early observers would have used. And then we launch into some regional and some background information about our place within the galaxy and within the universe itself. So prepare to feel a little insignificant at times with some of this information. And we close up with some general facts about the solar system, once again to try and add to your framework of terms and concepts that you'll deal with through the rest of this course. Now in Module 2, on the Bright Space site, you'll find two presentations. One of them really talks mostly about early observations of the solar system and early information, and the other one is more focused on that regional context, that bigger context of the universe and the galaxy. Have a look through those and you'll find a lot more detail about some of the things that I will briefly cover today. So now on slide 3, well, first of all, we've been looking at the skies for a very, very long time, probably as long as they've been human beings, they've been looking at the sky. It was pretty dark in the early days, there wasn't a lot to do at night, and the skies were very clear. So we could look at the skies all of the time. We could see the sun, we could see the moon, we could see all the stars. And inevitably, we kind of placed a lot of significance on this stuff. You know, we placed our gods in the skies for the most part. So really, these are the beginnings of things. But early on, human beings realized that certain things that they could observe in the heavens were also of practical use to them as well. And this is really where the origins of astronomy lie. The origins of astronomy lie in mythical things connected with gods and goddesses and omens and things like that. But they also lie in very practical purposes, such as using the stars for early navigation and using them also in agriculture. So let's have a look at this. Slide 4, that's a map of the Middle East, as it would be today, showing some of the empires and some of the states that existed in early history. Right? And really, this is where the first written records of observations from astronomy come from. They come from this area at about 3,000 years before the Christian era. Okay? So these were partly of mystical origin, of course, but they were also partly of practical origin, because people realized that there were ways to measure time in the skies, and there were ways also to measure direction within the skies too. And what we find in early astronomical observations, which are also observations of the solar system to a large extent, is evidence that this was largely done for very practical purposes. Next slide. So a very famous place in Britain, of course, is Stonehenge. You've probably heard of this. Stonehenge is a stone circle built with stones that came from very long distances when they were put together. And it dates from around 3000 before the Christian era. So it dates from around that same time period. There are loads and loads of structures like this in Europe. Some of them are made of stone. Others were not made of stone and haven't survived as well. But they're all over the place, and they were certainly an important part of early history in Europe. There's no question about that. What are they? They probably have astronomical significance. So to the next slide now, on the summer solstice, which is the longest day of the year, of course, in the Northern Hemisphere, on June 21st, the sun rises in a particular spot at Stonehenge. And the same is true for other events within the calendar, like the equinoxes and also the winter solstice as well, which we normally celebrate just before Christmas. So Stonehenge appears to have had astronomical significance, and modern British Druids still go to Stonehenge on June the 21st to watch the sunrise, but now it's not possible to go in and wander around the monument like you used to be able to do when I was a kid. I remember going there and touching the stones. You can't do that anymore, obviously, because it's an historic site. Next slide. This is 5.7. These are fairly similar things that were built by indigenous people in North America over very long periods of time. Some of them go back around to the same time as Stonehenge. They're not as well preserved and they're not as clear in terms of their astronomical alignments, but they are believed to have astronomical significance and in some cases align with particular stars. They're not as well understood, perhaps, as the monuments like Stonehenge, but nevertheless, they appear to have been used to track time and perhaps to serve as some sort of calendar, and also to mark particular events and particular times within the year. Next slide. This is slide 8. This is Peru here on a mountain ridge. There is what is believed to be the oldest true astronomical observatory that would look at things over time. And these are structures that are built on the ridge that will align with the directions of sunrise and sunset at particular times, including the summer and winter solstices again. Now, if you don't know what the summer and winter solstices are, they're the times of the longest day and the shortest day in particular hemispheres. But these structures in Peru now are slightly inaccurate. They're not quite positioned exactly as they should be. And the reason for this, of course, is because although we think of the patterns we see in the sky as being constant, they're not really constant. Some of them do change over time, and there are aspects of the Earth's rotation on its axis that change over time too. So some of these parameters have changed over the time of human history as well. Okay? They're not as constant as we might think. Next slide. Now to slide 9. Basically, we're talking here about very practical astronomy as compared to theoretical astronomy, which we'll talk about more in Module 4 when we come to discuss the evolution of modern ideas about the solar system. This was a practical thing. They were really mostly interested in agriculture to a large extent. They wanted to know when to plant crops, when to harvest them, possibly other things like when to collect taxes too. And it appears that most of these structures were designed more to act as calendars. They really weren't designed to trace the motions of heavenly bodies, aside from the one in Peru, perhaps, and they had to be calibrated by looking at them over a long period of time. But obviously, there was lots of time available. We may not have all of the records, but people did keep records. People did measure these things over time. And you don't have to look at the sky for very long. You can just look at it for a year or two, really, and you'll understand that there's complexity. For example, the length of the day is different at different times of the year. Sometimes the sun is high in the sky, sometimes it's low in the sky. So there are lots of things that early people could observe and early people would want to understand as well, even though their purposes for doing so were largely connected to practical things like agriculture. Next slide. So here's some things that you can look at. You can see quite easily. You don't need a telescope or anything like that. You can see the motion of the sun in the sky. You can see changes in sunrise and sunset and the length of the day. You can also observe the phases of the moon. The moon looks different at different times of what we call months, which actually months are defined by the phases of the moons, even though they're not the same as calendar months. You can also see patterns in the sky, in the stars. The stars have distinctive patterns, and they seem to be fixed. The stars will move with the seasons, and they'll move through the night as you watch them. But their patterns will remain fixed. And other things that early people could undoubtedly see were peculiar stars that seemed to move through the stars in an unusual but rather predictable pattern. In other words, they weren't behaving like all the other stars that you could look at. And every so often, they would see things like solar eclipses and lunar eclipses. And solar eclipses in particular were considered very important. They were considered to be very scary events and often harbingers of disaster and things like that. So a lot of effort went into trying to predict eclipses. Next slide. We won't talk about this stuff in detail because more information is present in the detailed presentations, but we all know that the sun's path through the sky is different at different times of the year. The sun is higher in the sky in the summer than it is in the winter, and the days are longer in the summer. We all know this, okay? So that's something we can easily see. Okay, there's two times in the year when the day and the night have equal lengths, and those are called equinoxes. Okay, and that's where the word equinox comes from. And that's the spring equinox and the fall equinox are the times when the day has an equal length to the night that follows it. Okay, so that's another important observation as well. Equinoxes are important because the spring equinox is the time you want to start planting your crops in the northern hemisphere, for sure. Okay? And the fall equinox is when you're going to begin to harvest them, generally. Okay? So we think of those patterns as permanent. They're not exactly permanent. Okay? These things do change over time. Okay? We still celebrate the solstices, often in religious events. Christmas, for example, is very much an ancient festival that celebrates the winter solstice, which is a recognition that spring will indeed come again and that winter won't last forever. It long predates the Christian era. Okay? The seasons actually would shift in time if we left them alone long enough. Our calendar actually deals with this problem. One of the reasons we have leap years is to keep us in sync, because the Earth's year is slightly more than 365 days. That's one reason. But also to account for a wobble in the Earth's rotation axis. The Earth's rotation axis wobbles a bit like a child's toy or a spinning top as it would move around. So that changes our seasons in deep time. But basically, a solar calendar was developed by most early civilizations on the Earth that was used to track these events and presumably to guide things like agriculture and other aspects of their culture. Okay, next slide. The phases of the moon. Well, again, we won't talk about this in detail because you've all seen these. The moon changes its appearance through time. There are times when you can hardly see it at all. It's called a new moon. And then it will gradually become larger, and it will become a full moon, and then it will work back again to a new moon. So, there's a cycle here, and early people could see these at all. It's also a cycle that's connected with tides as well, because it relates to the relative position of the sun and the moon. So, these were things that were obviously observed, and this is where our concept of months generally comes from. Okay? And tides are obviously very important. They were probably very important to the evolution of life on Earth as well, but we'll talk about that later on. But there's another thing that can easily be seen, and to which significance can definitely be ascribed. Okay, to the next slide. This one is slide 14, solar eclipses. Well, every so often, the sun is blocked by the moon. The light from the sun is blocked by the moon. And this always happens at a time of a new moon. But that doesn't mean you get a solar eclipse every time there's a new moon. You get lots of new moons in the year and you won't see a solar eclipse. You'll only see them from certain places on the Earth. Now, these were seen as very scary events, malevolent things, really, and a lot of effort went into predicting them. But really what they are, of course, are a function of the geometry of orbits in the solar system. Every so often, the moon's orbit goes in front of the position of the sun in our sky, which blocks the light from it. And that's when we see the corona of the sun, which actually has an atmosphere that we normally cannot see. So eclipses are a function of planetary motions, particularly lunar planetary motions in this case. So the next slide, which is slide 15, we also have lunar eclipses, which are the reverse of that situation. That's when the moon seems to grow dim because it's passing through the Earth's shadow. So that's a very similar thing, and that will only happen when there's a full moon. Okay? And the most spectacular lunar eclipses are what are called blood moons, and this is when the position of the moon is such that from where you're looking at it on the Earth's surface, the light that illuminates the moon is passing through much of the atmosphere at a low angle. And that removes some of the wavelengths of light, but it leaves the longer wavelengths, the red wavelengths, which illuminate the moon in this rather striking red colour. Okay? So once again, these were seen as particularly scary events that had great significance for prediction of the future and things like that. So eclipses really are at the heart of astronomical observations, which is kind of interesting to think about. Next slide. Okay, slide 16, just a list of what the causes are of these things. We now understand what all these represent. We know that the sun rises and sets because the Earth rotates on its axis. It doesn't rise and set because the sun is moving around the Earth. We know that the variations in the pattern of the sun and the length of the day through the year are because the Earth's rotation axis is inclined with respect to its orbital path around the sun. And that changes the apparent path of the sun from a given place on the Earth. And we also know that when we look at the moon and we see changes in its appearance, this is recording changes in the relative positions of the sun, the moon, and the Earth so that it's illuminated differently. Now, there was a time when people thought that the moon had a dark side that was always dark, and there's even a famous rock album called The Dark Side of the Moon, which you've probably heard of too. Well, that's not true. There is no dark side on the moon. The other side of the moon that we never see gets just as much sunlight as the sight we see. It just gets it at a different time. And eclipses, they are a complex product of orbital geometry, motions of and the orbits of the bodies in the Earth-Moon-Sun system. And that's a more complicated topic that we'll come back to when we talk about the moon, and also come back to in the next module as well. But basically, all of these things result from motions within the solar system, the rotation of our planet, and its movement around the sun, its orbit around the moon, and the relative orbits of other bodies in the solar system. So just to return briefly to the idea of eclipses, because there's another important point that we want to make here, and that's the origin of what we call the ecliptic. Okay, so let's have a look at the next slide. Slide 17. This is important. Remember this. Okay. Eclipses always occur in the same plane in the sky. Okay, and that plane is called the ecliptic plane. And it's called that plane because that's the only place where an eclipse can occur. The moon has to be in that plane. It's the only place where the moon can come between us and the sun. And that is also the same plane in the sky where wandering stars that we call planets move through the sky. So this is obviously something that's very important, and the ancient peoples of the world recognized this. And we know the reason for this now, okay? They didn't at the time. So the ecliptic plane is actually the plane of the Earth's orbit. It's the plane of the Earth's orbit through the center of the sun. So think of it as a big flat dish, like a dinner plate, okay? And the reason we only get eclipses at rare intervals on the Earth is because the moon has an orbit that's not in the same plane. The moon has an orbit that's inclined to the ecliptic plane. So that means that it's relatively rare for the moon to cross the ecliptic plane at the same time when the Earth and the sun are lined up with the position of the moon. Okay? It takes those circumstances to do it. It does happen, and it happens on a repeated basis. But it can't happen all the time because they're in different orbital planes. And the ecliptic plane is also shared by most of the planets in the solar system very closely. They do deviate very slightly from it, but for the most part, planets lie within a few degrees of the ecliptic plane. So that means that we see them in the same part of the sky as well. So that's an important concept. Remember that one. Next one. Just to talk about the stars now, they have a rather different behaviour. They go from east to west on a daily basis every night, just like the sun and the moon would do as well. Okay, and they have patterns in them that seem to be fixed. However, you can't see all the constellations from any one location on the Earth. Okay, some constellations are only seen in the northern hemisphere, some are only seen in the southern hemisphere, some are only seen at particular times of year as well. And again, that's because the Earth's axis of rotation is inclined. However, if you wait long enough, they'll always come back to the same locations at the same time in the following year. So they are predictable. And we use some of them, for this reason, we use some of them for navigation too. One of them is Polaris, what's called the pole star, which always represents the direction of the north in the northern hemisphere. So we navigate using them. Now, we think of those things as being constant, but they're not exactly constant. There is a wobble in the Earth's rotation axis, which means that Polaris has not always been the North Pole star. Other stars have been in that position, nearby stars. And this also, over time, would change some of the constellation patterns very slightly, but not to any extent that we could ever see. Okay? So, to all intents and purposes, they remain fixed. You're probably familiar with the constellations. There are 88 of them in total. And we interpret them in terms of patterns that we interpret for different things. This is Orion the Hunter, one of the best known of all the constellations that you can see quite well from where we are. And basically, they have no real meaning from a scientific perspective. The patterns we see are apparent patterns. Those stars are at quite different distances from the Earth. So if we were to look at them from another direction, it would look quite different. But they are useful, and they're useful because they're used as a kind of geography of the sky. constellations are used to indicate where things are. If you say that something is in Orion, there's a thing called the Orion Nebula that's very important from the perspective of understanding the formation of stars and planetary systems. And there are other references to different parts of the sky. So think of them like the names we use for places in the globe. We use Europe, we use Africa, we use South Asia, we may say Indonesia, for example. These areas of the Earth that we define geographically or politically. Well, the constellations serve the same function to astronomy. They tell you where to look for things. Okay, now the other bit that's important in terms of ancient understanding of the solar system, of course, are the planets. Okay? Planets have been observed for a very long time again. Over the course of a night, they'll move across east to west with the stars. They'll seem to be more or less in one place all night, and they'll move across. But if you watch them for a period of time, a planet will not be fixed relative to the stars. It's usually going to travel in the other direction. It's going to go from west to east through the fixed patterns of the stars. But not always, because every so often, a planet will seem to go back in the other direction. It'll seem to turn around and go west again from east, and then turn around again and keep heading east. And most of the planets do this to different extents. And this is called retrograde motion. And it was a big problem for early models of the solar system, as we'll find out in the next module. How do you explain this pattern? Well, one thing you do know is that all the planets move more or less within the ecliptic plane. They're very closely aligned with the same plane where we would see eclipses of the moon or the sun to occur as well. Okay? So the motion of planets is wandering. And planets is actually an ancient Greek word for travellers or wanderers, and that's what they're called. They're wandering stars. And the ancient people knew of five of them, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter and Saturn, not the other ones that we now know further out. However, ancient astronomers generally considered the sun and the moon to represent planets as well. But their motions are not the same, but they grouped them all together. Now remember that nobody had a way to really estimate size or distance in these days at all. Okay, so we really didn't know how far away things were, and we'll come to that in a moment. And one other thing that we need to clear up to is the relationship between the zodiac and the ecliptic. Okay, as we said, the sun, the moon, and the planets all move in the same path through the sky, and that's called the ecliptic plane, where we see eclipses. Okay, as the planets move, they will seem to move position against a background of constellations. So there are 12 constellations that sit on the ecliptic plane. And those 12 constellations are known as the zodiac. And they are supposed to have astrological significance. In other words, when a planet is in a particular constellation, it's supposed to affect the course of your life, maybe your financial good fortune, or maybe your love life. Who's to say? Okay? They're the ones we call the signs of the zodiac, which I think most of you are familiar with. Okay? They also represent the place where the sun would sit at a given time of the year if you could see it at night. But of course you can't. Okay? It's only during the day. I'm a Pisces. I was born on March the 3rd. I won't tell you what year. You all different star signs as well. Does any of this make a difference? Well, mostly it's rubbish. Well, it's entirely rubbish. But it continues to fascinate some people. So this has no real significance. But once again, it does have geographic use. These are areas of the sky that we can describe in different ways. So that's where that comes from. And if you choose to continue to believe in astrology, well, that's up to you. But there really isn't any scientific basis for any of this stuff at all. Next slide. Well, if planets wander, there are also ultimate wanderers. And the ultimate wanderers are comets. Comets are things that appear, or to ancient observers, they appeared to show up in the sky without any notification whatsoever. They were there for a while, and then they'd be gone again, and they'd never be seen again. Okay? And many comets, in fact, are only seen by one generation of observers. So unless there were proper records, there was no real way to track these things. Comets do, in fact, have regular patterns, but many of them, of course, have very long time spans between their appearances in the skies of the Earth. Okay? Halley's Comet, which is the most famous comet of all, has a relatively short period. In other words, it comes back and forth about every 76 years. So it is sometimes seen by more than one generation. Most are not. Okay. Another thing that happens in the sky that nobody could predict in ancient times, even though we might be able to predict them a bit better now, are novas and supernovas, or novae or supernovae. Suddenly bright stars. Stars that suddenly seem to become very bright and much, much more obvious than they ever were in the past. And you know that a star of this kind, of course, is part of Christian mythology. What are these? Okay, they're stars that have suddenly decided to explode in some way and shell out all of their energy at one time. And we can't really predict where or when these will occur. We can predict the kinds of stars that will eventually do it, but we still don't know exactly when. So that's kind of a little survey of ancient observations of the sky, long before astronomy was ever a science and ever thought of seriously. We'll take a few moments to just contrast this with what we know today and how we know some of that stuff, just to introduce some more concepts. So let's take a look at the next slide. Slide 23. This is a picture of the Hubble telescope. Well, the telescope had a huge impact on our observation of the sky. But an early development was the development of instruments by the ancient Greeks that could measure angles in the sky. And they had an important impact as well, as we'll find out in the next module. Okay? We could then measure things and find out where things are and where their positions changed over time. Now, nowadays, we have orbital telescopes. This is the Hubble telescope here. The latest orbital telescope is the James Webb telescope. We're going to talk about this in our space news item next week, I'd say. And this is quite a remarkable project that we'll talk about. And we also have lots of good methods that we didn't have in the old days for looking at things from the Earth. So telescopes made a big difference to astronomy and continue to do so. So we had that advantage of being able to see things much more clearly. Next slide. You have seen this slide before. If you've looked at Module 2, you're going to see it again quite a few times through this course. This is the electromagnetic spectrum. In the old days, we were limited to visible light. We had no instruments to measure anything else. We just had our eyes. And in the early days of telescopes, this was true as well. But in fact, there's a wide range of radiation that's associated with stars and planetary objects, and we can measure across this range and get a lot of other information. So if, for example, we use infrared, we're able to look at distant galaxies far more clearly than we can in the visible light spectrum. If we want to understand the surface of Venus, we have to use radar. Okay, radar is our method for looking at the surface of Venus because it's obscured by clouds and we need to see through those clouds. So this is very important. We're able to take advantage of this wide range of information. Now, another thing that's interesting in this context is that direct samples of material show up on the Earth from outer space at various times. Meteorites, for example. Now, meteorites were certainly known to the ancients. They're certainly described in a few places. They're usually ascribed to the gods and to celestial events and things like that. What they are, of course, are bits of space junk left over from the formation of the solar system that occasionally end up on the Earth. And they make craters. This is Barringer Crater in Australia, a very famous crater, about 50,000 years old, so it's quite well preserved. And there's a fragment in the meteorite that actually created this thing. Okay? So meteorites are pretty important. They give us information, and they were actually very important even to our distant ancestors. There are examples of early tools that were made from iron, and the only source of iron that was really available in the Stone Age was from meteorites. If you found a meteorite, you had a source of metal. You had no other way to make metal from iron ore or anything like that in the very early days of human history. So they were important in a lot of other respects as well. They are very important today because they tell us something about the early history of the solar system. They tell us something about the composition of the solar system, the material that went to form it, and various other things too. Next slide is slide 26, which is a picture from the moon. Okay, so astronauts went there for about 3 years during the Apollo program, and they came back with a load of rock samples too. So, although that's hardly a vast representative collection of material from the moon, it tells us about the composition and the age of the lunar surface. Okay, we've also brought back samples from other things in the solar system too, particularly from comets, from dust clouds associated with comets. And we left stuff around to take measurements too. So there are seismometers on the moon that are there to detect moonquakes. Moonquakes are very, very rare, but they do occur once in a while. Most of them are probably related to impacts. Okay, we know that the moon's surface is made of a rock type that's very common on the Earth's surface as well, with very little difference. Those rocks look very similar. Okay, next slide. Well, we certainly hope that one day in the future there will be observations made of the surfaces of other planets. There are geologists who are a bit crazy. They like to put on spacesuits and pretend that they're doing field work on Mars just to see how this would actually work. I think it would be quite difficult, but nevertheless, one day it will come. And to gain a full understanding of other planets, this is really what we have to do. There is no substitute for being able to go there in person. But in the meantime, we do have some pretty good stand-ins to do work on other planets on our behalf. So the next slide there, I refer, of course, to the exploration rovers that are active on Mars. These were the two rovers that did a lot of the work, Spirit and Opportunity, starting around 2004, running around, looking at things, picking up samples, gathering data, taking photographs. So this was like having geologists on Mars, remote geologists who could look around and find out things. And that's been an enormously successful program that really has captured the public a lot as well. And of course, there are other rovers there now. The Curiosity rover went there in 2012. Curiosity is exploring a very specific region on Mars that has evidence for ancient sedimentary rocks, suggesting the presence of water. And so there are instruments on these rovers that can do simple analytical work to identify things and get a lot of high-resolution imagery. So Mars is really a prime focus for this kind of research, for the very reason that it is the most Earth-like of all of the planets, and this will continue over time for sure. And here's the latest generations now. This is 2021, the Perseverance rover, just there a few years now. And we now even have a helicopter on Mars. We have a device that can fly in an atmosphere that's only a fraction of Earth's thickness, a very, very thin atmosphere. And as you probably know, there are plans to return human astronauts to the moon in 2022. We launched the initial trial of the rockets for what's called the Artemis project. Okay, so this will happen over time. So things are happening, and there is a move towards resuming exploration on the moon and also in other parts of the solar system, with the idea of eventually being able to send humans to Mars. Next slide. Well, you'll find out in this course that many aspects of terrestrial planets are actually quite familiar. Mars in particular has a lot of things that we see on the Earth. This kind of breaks down when we head out beyond the orbit of Mars. When we go out to the outer solar system, things are very, very different. But for the rest of this overview, we're going to go even further than the solar system. We're going to go and take a look at some of the wider context of the solar system within the galaxy and the universe. This is the only part of the course in which we do this. It's fascinating material, but we can only really scratch the surface of this topic. So just to reiterate a point that we have made a couple of times already, in the next slide, we have to look for Earth. Earth somewhere in that photograph. It's a tiny blue dot within that grey band. It's very hard to find, so we are definitely not very significant on the scale of the solar system, and certainly not on the scale of the universe. The solar system is enormous. The distance to the orbit of Neptune is about 4.6 billion kilometers. Okay? And we'll come back to that at the end of this overview. So, what can we say about moving even further afield? Take a look at slide 33. Well, we're part of what's called the Milky Way galaxy. Okay? We're actually in one of the arms of a spiral galaxy. The Milky Way galaxy is a spiral object. And we're about halfway out from the galactic center. The Milky Way galaxy is huge. It's about 80,000 light years across from one side to the other. Okay. Now, we talked in module 2 about what a light year is. It's a very, very long distance, I can tell you that. Okay. 80,000 light years is an enormous distance. However, it's still a very small distance on the scale that exists beyond the galaxy. In the other photo here, this is a representation of the cluster of galaxies of which we are a part. Milky Way is one of these. Our nearest neighbour, Andromeda, is just above us there. Okay? Andromeda is 7 million light years away from the Milky Way galaxy. So that particular photograph, it's not a photograph, that particular representation there has billions of light years across it. Okay? So once again, the scale is immense here. You know, we are very, very small on the scale of the universe. And we can go even further than that too. Take a look at chapter 1 in your textbook for an interesting explanation of some of this. Next slide. So this is not a photograph or an image or anything like that. This is a representation of the large-scale structure of the universe, or part of the universe. So it shows the distribution of galaxies, basically. All those bright areas are places where there's lots of galaxies. The dark areas are places where there's very few galaxies. Okay? And you can see that there's a large-scale structure to the universe here. You can see that there are areas where galaxies are densely clustered, quite bright, areas where they're very dark by comparison, so very few galaxies exist in those areas. Those are large tracts of largely empty space. There are also things that look like filaments in here, as if galaxies are arranged in filaments, and you can see that in the previous image too, of the galaxies that exist near to the Milky Way. So this occupies many billions of light years, this image here. So it gives you an idea of the total scale. So we can't even find the Milky Way galaxy in there, and we certainly can't find the solar system or the Earth within that. So the scale is truly beyond comprehension, which is why we need exponential notation, as discussed in Module 2, which gives you some background information. So what can we say about the origins and the history of the universe? Well, the next slide just has a very quick summary here. We're not going to get into discussing some of these matters because they're really topics entirely in themselves. It's believed that all of the mass and the energy in the universe as we see it was once packed into a single, tiny, small, infinitesimal point. And this exploded about 13.7 billion years ago, and the universe has been expanding ever since. It took about a billion years for the first stars and galaxies to form, and they've been forming ever since. Now, the universe is unimaginably huge. We really can't see the edge of it, you know. But it's not unimaginably old, because it did have a beginning. But how do we know that it had a beginning? How can we time the start of the universe? Well, that brings us to concept of the expanding universe, and also the work of a man called Edwin Hubble. Next slide. Here's Edwin Hubble, and he's often called the father of cosmology, but what he did was establish that the universe is expanding by measuring the velocity of galaxies that could be observed with various telescopes. And he did this by using spectroscopy, measuring the emitted radiation from distant galaxies. And there's a way in which we can use this to establish the speed and direction of motion. So what he showed was that all the galaxies in the universe are moving away from ours, and the further away they appear to be, and we'll get to talk a little moment about how we figured that out, the faster they were moving. They were receding at increasing rates. So this is the basis of what's called the expanding universe. And of course, if you know how fast things are moving, you can back calculate their motion, okay, and their acceleration, and arrive at an estimate of when they were all in the same place. So that's where that 13.7 billion years comes from. Next slide, please. This is slide 37. This is the balloon analogy for the expanding universe. This is the most common analogy. Imagine you have a balloon with a whole bunch of little dots on it. But if you blow that balloon up, those dots are going to be further and further apart all the time. If the balloon was actually kind of solid inside and had dots through its interior, they would also all be moving apart through the period of time when the balloon was expanding. So that's the basic concept. So, coming back to the Milky Way, or in fact to Andromeda, this is a representation of what the Milky Way probably looks like. We know that the universe contains a very, very large number of galaxies and stars, okay, and that they differ too in their characteristics. But within our solar system, we know that the Sun formed about 4.6 billion years ago. Okay, we'll discuss later how we know that. It's about halfway through its lifespan. And the solar system, what we inhabit and the other planets, formed at roughly the same time. And both the planets and the Sun, of course, have evolved over that time period. So we'll talk about the details of these later on. So our solar system has a very long history, but it's only part of the history of the universe. To the next slide now. Now, we did show this picture before. This is a globular star cluster located a very long way from the Earth. But what it illustrates is the different sizes and colours of stars. So stars are not all the same. That's clear from looking at the sky. But what do these differences mean? What kinds of stars are out there that make up galaxies? And what are the differences between them? But one of the things we need to know in trying to understand this is have a way of figuring out how far away things are. How do we know the distances to stars? How can we figure this out? Okay? Well, there is quite a simple method that works for stars that are relatively close to where we are. Okay? And that's called parallax, and that's actually the same method that's used in surveying and a number of other things in engineering too. So let's just briefly examine that. It's discussed in more detail in the second part of Module 3 in the detailed presentations. Okay, so let's suppose we're looking at something in space at some distance from the Earth, and we look at it from two places on either side of the Earth. Okay? Well, what we would find is that its angular position relative to stars, which are very, very far away in this particular case, is not the same. Okay? It appears to shift when we change the position of our observation because we see it from a different angle. And that means that we can make right-angle triangles. And when we make right-angle triangles, we can calculate relative lengths if we know something about it. We know angles, and we know the distance between the two points. We can figure out how far away that object is. Okay, that's all we need. Okay? Trigonometry is a very powerful tool. So this is the basis of what's called parallax. By looking at something from different positions, we can change, we can measure its relative shift, its apparent shift in location, and from that derive an estimate of the distance. Next slide. This just shows it in a diagrammatic form. If we look at the object from A, it seems to be in one place, but if we go to B, we seem to find it in another place. So if we know that angular distance, and we know the length of the baseline, then we can make two right-angle triangles, and we can figure out how far away it is. Okay, so that's a very powerful method, and it works quite well for objects that are relatively close to the Earth. For example, for things within the solar system, we can use parallax to estimate their distances at particular times. Next slide. For stellar measurements, we need to take a different approach because we need a longer baseline. But if we take measurements 6 months apart, the Earth is on opposite sides of the Sun. So that means that the baseline becomes 3 × 10^6 kilometers, or 2 astronomical units, as compared to about 12,000, 8,000 kilometers in the case of the diameter of the Earth. Okay? So we can use this for stars as well. Although the actual angular differences we see are very, very small, we can measure them with modern instruments, and we're able to detect this and measure the distances or estimate the distances to stars. And this is where the word parsec comes from. If a star is 3.2 light years away from the Earth, it would have a parallax angle of 1 second, okay, which is a very small distance, but it is one that we can measure. So we can use this to try and figure out where things are. For very distant stars and for galaxies, the angles are really too small. We can't see parallax at all. Okay? But we do have other spectroscopic methods that can be used to get the distances to stars as well. Okay? So we do have other methods that we can use to do that. So that's something to remember, an important concept. I will also say that early astronomers clung to the idea that the Sun went around the Earth and the Earth was the center of the universe because they were unable to measure parallax displacement for the stars. But that's because they didn't have instruments that could measure the very small apparent displacements that are observed. They couldn't get the information to show that that was the case. Next slide. So this is slide 43. This shows another way of estimating the distance to something. It's called the small angular formula. In other words, if you can see something and it's actually got some sort of a diameter, Its apparent diameter is a function of its actual size and how far away it is. And that's obvious to us, okay? If we look at a plane in the sky, it's very tiny, but really it's quite a big object if we were to look at it on the runway of an airport, okay? So if we know how large an object is, we can measure its apparent size, and we know the distance to it. We can use the small angle formula, as we call it. Conversely, if we know how far away something is, and we know how big it looks, we can calculate its true size. Okay? And this is actually quite simple, because the angles are very small. It's a very simple formula. And this is something else that we can use too. So we have methods there. And we can, in fact, use this for some styles. Next slide. This is one of the largest stars that we know of. This is Betelgeuse, or Betelgeuse, as it's sometimes called. Okay? It's 600 times larger than the Sun. It's a long way away, but you can actually see the size of it. With a telescope, you can actually measure its diameter. Okay? And that enables you to get some idea of how far away it is. Okay? Because we have an idea of how big this star is, so we know its distance. And we can find its distance by other means as well. Okay? So this is one example. It's not commonly the case that you can do this. Next slide. Another thing we can use is to do with what's called the inverse square law. And we'll talk about more detail in this when we come to talk about electromagnetic radiation. But basically, any kind of radiation diminishes in intensity according to the square of the distance from it. So in other words, a distant star will produce a certain amount of energy. At a certain distance, that will diminish by 4 if we double the distance. If we triple the distance, it will diminish by 9. If we quadruple the distance, it will diminish by 16, and so on and so forth. So that's a rule that we can apply. If we know how much energy a star is emitting, and we know how much energy we can actually measure, its apparent brightness as seen from the Earth, compared to what its brightness should be based on other types of measurements, what its energy output should be, then that also gives us an idea of how far away it is too. Because obviously the further away it is, the dimmer it's going to be. So we have a number of methods that we can use to get information about stars, even though they're a very long way away from us. If we know how far away it is and how bright it is, we can estimate its luminosity, the energy it yields. It turns out that this has a relationship to the size of stars as well. Okay? Bright stars, or high-energy stars, are generally larger stars. The larger a star, the more energy it produces. That's quite sensible, really. We can also get information about the temperature of stars, too. And we do this, once again, from electromagnetic radiation. We'll talk about this more in the next module, okay? In a later module, I should say. So we can estimate the temperatures of stars as well. And we have another way for figuring out how big stars are, for getting their mass. We can actually use the laws of gravitation. Newton's laws of gravitation allow us to calculate the masses of stars in binary systems, where you have two stars that orbit one another. That allows us to calculate the mass of the larger star fairly accurately. So we have a number of ways that we can find out things like mass, like temperature, like energy production, and a variety of things about stars simply by measuring information from electromagnetic radiation and using other methods to try and figure out how far away they are. So, what does this tell us? That's really the most important thing, isn't it? That's what we want to know. Let's take a look at the next slide. So, slide 47, well, how big are stars? Well, they vary a great deal in their mass, okay? We can figure out the mass using gravity information, gravitational laws, and that also gives us information that we can correlate with other data. So here are some examples of different types of stars compared to the Sun. The Sun is not very large in this particular comparison. Lots of stars are much, much bigger than the Sun. In fact, Betelgeuse is huge compared to the Sun. So that gives us some information on stellar populations. We're able to calculate the masses of different types of stars. And different types of stars, of course, have different colours, and they have different apparent temperatures, too, that can be measured using electromagnetic radiation. And when all that goes together, we find not surprisingly, that there are patterns in this. Now, this particular chart here comes from your textbook, and it's kind of nice because it's a good analogue for how stellar populations are examined. If you imagine plotting the horsepower versus the weight of cars against one another, okay? And I think you'd understand that, for the most part, you'd find that they plotted more or less on a line, okay? The larger a car is, the heavier it is, and that means it needs a more powerful engine to have the same performance. And we might call that, if we liked, we could call it the main sequence of cars. Most cars will plot on that line. However, other more specialised vehicles would not plot on that line. Racing cars and sports cars would have much more power relative to their mass, and some of those really cheap cars that you can buy might have a lot less power relative to their mass, and they wouldn't perform as well. And although this has no connection with stellar populations, the patterns we see are actually very similar. If we plot up parameters that are measured for stars, we find that they form a general trend that we can identify and which we call the main sequence. Next slide. So this shows this here. So what you see here is temperature plotted against luminosity, which is the amount of energy that stars are producing. We can calculate the amount of energy they're producing because if we know how far away they are and we know their apparent brightness, then we know the amount of energy they're actually emitting. We can estimate that. And what we find is that most stars that we measure fall on a trend. It's not quite a line, it's slightly curved, but this is called the main sequence. So in other words, the main sequence contains most of the stars that we look at in different places. And it turns out that different kinds of stars have different positions on that line, because we can figure out the masses of stars, and it turns out that the mass of stars is generally related to their temperature. The surface temperature of stars, which we estimate from radiation, is very high for very large stars and relatively low for small stars with the sun in the middle. So the main sequence is connected somehow to the actual mass of stars. Larger stars produce a lot more radiation. They have different colours. They tend to be white or even blue or violet. Very smaller stars, the much smaller stars, tend to be red. They have less mass in them. They're red, they're orange, those sorts of colours. And in the middle we have yellow and white stars that resemble the sun in general terms. The sun is a yellow star. So there's a relationship between these things. So what this means is that the larger a star is, the more energy it's producing, and the higher its surface temperature is. So that's an important relationship, and once we know that relationship, that then gives us a way of finding out distances to other stars as well, and filling in information. So we can take information that we gain from a subgroup of stars and apply it to all of them as well. And what do we find? That's really what's important, I think, is what is the conclusion from this? Well, the conclusion is that there are good stars and bad stars from the perspective of planetary science. Massive hot stars, these very big stars that are high surface temperatures emitting bright white or blue or violet light, are not very good places for habitable planets to exist. Two reasons. The first is that they emit a whole lot of nasty radiation. In addition to that light, they're emitting things like X-rays and gamma rays and things of that nature. Lots of ultraviolet too. But more importantly, they don't hang around for very long. Large stars have very short lifespans. They generally only exist for about 100 million years or less. Now that's a long time, but it's not much time for evolution, because it took 4.5 billion years for evolution to bring us to the life forms that we see today on the Earth, including us. Okay? Large stars run out of fuel quickly. They have enormous amounts of fuel. They're burning hydrogen, turning it into helium, but they quickly shift to more energetic fusion reactions because they run out of fuel, and then they explode as novas or supernovas. That's what happens to them. They blow up eventually because the energy production runs away and it becomes greater than the force of gravity which is trying to keep the star together. On the other hand, dwarf stars, small stars, are very long-lived. They're red or orange in colour and they can be there for a long time. They may not have a lot of fuel, but they burn that fuel at a very slow rate. But they're still probably not good places, because they're only going to have a very narrow zone around them where temperatures for a planet would be sufficient to allow life to exist. Okay? So they have a small habitable zone. We can add this to the observation that many stars actually form binary systems, where two stars orbit one another. They're probably not good candidates for planetary systems either, because it would be quite difficult to have a stable planetary orbit when you have two large masses within the system. So that's the bad news there too. But there is some very good news here too, is that stars that resemble the Sun are actually very common on the scale of the galaxy and the scale of the universe. Okay? They are probably some of the most common types. Next slide. So this is just shown here as a pie chart. This is the distribution of the sizes of stars compared to that of the Sun. So it's expressed in terms of solar masses. So compared to the Sun, these light stars are huge. Okay, they're as much as 20 to 600 times larger than the Sun, okay, in terms of their mass. But the majority of stars within the galaxy and the universe are actually smaller than the Sun. Okay? And there are a very large number of stars that fit within that general range between about half the Sun's size and about twice the Sun's size, which would appear to be the range of stars that would be likely to have habitable planets that could be in reasonable conditions, at a reasonable distance from the star, without too much harmful radiation, and also stars that have relatively long lifespans that would allow potential for the evolution of life. So we still don't really know how many solar systems there are. We do know that there's lots and lots of planets around other stars now. Okay, how many of them are like the Earth? That's a more open question that we'll come back to discuss later on. But there is no shortage of candidates for suitable stars to have solar systems that might resemble the one we are familiar with. So, moving to the end of this overview now, the very last bit of Module 3 talks about the solar system a little bit more to provide a bit more information about it for your reference. Okay, so we'll just quickly mention a little bit about this. Once again, as you know, there are 8 planets within the solar system. This particular graphic here, which is slide 52, does not show them according to their actual size. They're much smaller than they appear. And the distances are also schematic too. Okay? But you can see that the inner planets are much smaller than the outer planets. So this is really just a cartoon. To the next slide. Just to re-emphasize the true scale of the solar system. This is a true scale diagram which shows that it's 4.5 billion kilometers from the Sun to the orbit of Neptune. A couple of things to note here. First of all the planets orbit the Sun in an anti-clockwise direction when viewed from above. Okay, that's very important in terms of understanding the origins of the solar system. Second thing is that all of the planets are close to the ecliptic plane, the ecliptic plane being the plane that includes the Earth's orbit and the center of the Sun. They may not be exactly on the ecliptic plane, but they're very close to it. You can see here that Pluto is actually well outside the ecliptic plane, which is one of the reasons why it's no longer considered a planet. So bear in mind that true scale and also the importance of the ecliptic plane. Next slide. Once again, this just shows that common sense of rotation, that anti-clockwise rotation that's shown here, okay, that's present for all objects in the solar system. Anti-clockwise direction of orbital motion, I should say. In terms of their rotation, all of the planetary objects, with two exceptions, also rotate on their axes in an anti-clockwise direction. Those two exceptions are Venus and Uranus, and we'll talk about those specifically later on. But most of the things in the solar system are spinning in the same direction, and they're moving in the same direction. Okay, to the last slide. Slide 55. A picture of the ecliptic plane. Okay? It's not often that you have a situation where a large number of planets are all visible in one region of the sky. But every so often they are, and when that happens, they line up. So this is the ecliptic here. It's got 5 of the planets in there, okay? And it shows how they're all lined within aligned with this band in the sky. So you can think about this as all of these 5 planets are more or less around a line that connected the Earth to Saturn at this time. They're not exactly on that line, but they're in the plane of the ecliptic, which contains that line. Okay, that's quite a lot of stuff. That will take us through now in the next module, Module 4. We'll start to talk more about the development of modern ideas about the solar system, and then in particular about motions within the solar system. So thank you for your attention. I hope that that's been informative. Have a look at the more detailed presentations that'll fill in some of the details that I skipped over, and we'll see you again shortly, or we'll be talking to you again shortly.